A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 21, 1985, in the series God, Our Ally, entitled The God Who Is Absent. The texts for the sermon are Job 23, verses 3 and 10, and Mark 15, verse 34. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
God is our ally. He is there for us. He undergirds our lives and overshadows us. And I am trying in these weeks from various angles and a multiplicity of biblical texts to make that point, to write it indelibly upon your minds and hearts, to underscore it in order that in every experience of life, it may be the immediate reaction of your heart to affirm God is my ally. But God, our ally, is sometimes experienced in the absence, in the dark night of the soul. And the absence of God can be extremely painful in the darkness, very dark. And it is necessary to affirm that God is our ally. Also, when the experience of His presence is the experience of His absence. Also, when the heavens are brass and our prayers penetrate no higher than the ceiling. When all is dark and we feel cut off, isolated and alone, then too, it is important, even in the darkness which we cannot fathom, to trust in the God who is our ally. This message addresses those times and seasons of the absence of God. When we cannot break through and we have no sense of His presence. Biblical preaching must deal honestly with the absence of God. Biblical preaching is not a superficial message filled with sentimentality that simply gives one a pep talk, enabling one to go out into life again and knock them dead that next week. Biblical preaching cannot be simply an upbeat, positive message that denies the darkness while pointing to light. Biblical preaching must deal honestly with the absence of God as well as pointing to His presence. For that is true to human experience, and it is true to the Scripture. Superficial, sentimental pep talks may do well for one for whom all is going well, but they will offend the serious soul, and particularly the one who is experiencing the darkness. And the darkness is very real. And the absence of God brings fear and trembling. And the experience of His absence is a real part of our human experience. And so this morning, let me own on behalf of us all, the reality of the absence of God, those times of darkness, the dark night of the soul, when no light breaks through and there seems to be no clue as to the meaning of it all. At such times, too, God is our ally. One of my great concerns in preaching is that people will come in with deep needs, which will not be ministered to, but rather perhaps exacerbated by the very preaching of the word. I am always so sensitive to the fact that there are those of you out there who in a multiplicity of experiences may find that you are in that dark night of the soul and you are experiencing the absence of God. And then to hear the positive message of the gospel, which speaks of the power of God and the peace of God, may simply say to you that you are totally outside, and it may even grind you down farther, because all of that which is spoken of and all of that which is sung about is so alien to the experience of that season in your life. Coming to church at times like that can be a devastating experience. And indeed, it is often, and for good reason, when we need God most, that we may tend to withdraw and cut ourselves off from the only source of hope and encouragement that may possibly come to us. But oftentimes that is the fault of the church, because we have failed to own the darkness. We have failed to linger long enough with the anguish, which is so much a part of the human scene. We have been so quick to give the answers that we have not waited sufficiently to hear the questions. We have been so quick to offer comfort without first having any sense of the pain. This morning, let us acknowledge the darkness. This morning, let us recognize the absence of God in some seasons and moments of our lives. And if we're true to the Scriptures and true to human experience, then we can do no other. I want to take you to the Scriptures this morning, to the classic statement of the mystery of suffering in the Old Testament, the book of Job. The book of Job is familiar. Job is a familiar character. The book in the Old Testament was dealing with the popular wisdom of the day that said you can always connect a person's trouble with his sin. The popular wisdom of the day, the axiom with which everyone operated and no one questioned, was that whatever disaster befell one was in direct proportion to the unrighteousness or the injustice or the guilt of his life. Consequently, there was an easy explanation for the suffering that was in the world. It was the consequence of the sin that was in the world. And in the book of Job, we have a biblical witness against that old wisdom. The book of Job acknowledges the darkness and the suffering of the innocent, and says it is a mystery. It cannot be rationalized or explained. It can only be resolved as one worships God in the darkness, not understanding. The opening part of this book, which is a drama, tells us that Job was a great and prosperous man. And then in scene one, we have the court of heaven. And we have God holding court and the angels coming and Satan comes and God says, proud of his servant Job, have you considered my servant Job, what a good man he is? And Satan, of course, says, well, does he serve God for nothing? Look how prosperous he is. God says, take it away from him. Test him. All is removed. He loses everything. Terrible calamity. Loses children and herds and flocks and houses and lands. Bereft of everything. Left only with himself. And he says, naked I came into the world, and naked I will return thence. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. obviously God won round one. And so scene two, the court of heaven again, Satan coming back in, God saying, told you. Satan says, yeah, that's true, but he says, touch his skin. Take his health. Get him where he lives. God says, go ahead, but spare his life. And you know the story, the terrible disease. So agonizing and anguishing that he goes out and sits on the ash heap, scraping the sores. And in that awful condition, that terrible suffering, his wife comes out and says to him, are you still unshaken in your integrity? And he says, if we accept good from God, shall we not accept evil? And he sits there, silent, in his suffering, not understanding. And then three friends come. And the magnitude of his suffering overwhelms them, and they sit for 7 days without saying a word. And then finally Job raises his voice. Finally he says, I don't understand. I haven't done anything. There's no secret sin that I'm hiding. I don't understand this affliction. Well, his friends were able to be silent as long as Job was silent. But now Job was speaking against the popular wisdom. Now Job was attacking their own little security system. They had life's mystery all settled. Sin equals suffering. Here's a man who is suffering. Obviously, he's a sinner. But he says, I'm not a sinner. This is not for something that I have done. And now they are mystified, and now their little religious system comes into challenge. And so now they go on the attack. They cannot possibly conceive of how the popular wisdom could be wrong. They say, oh no, Job. What are you saying, charging God that way? And so they go with a series of dialogue, a cycle of speeches through this book in a profound discussion of suffering. The first speaker says, now that adversity comes upon you, you lose patience. It touches you and you become unmanned. He sat with him for 7 days and understood his suffering. But let Job challenge his security system, and he goes on the attack. And he says to Job, spouting the popular understanding of things, what innocent man has ever perished? Where have you seen the upright destroyed? Job argues back. Another comes in. Job responds. Another comes in. Finally, Job, in frustration, in utter frustration over the dullness of his miserable comforters, unable to reason with them or to communicate with them, says in the words of our text, oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might enter into his court. Job says, I go forward, he is not there. Backward, I cannot find him. When I turn left, I do not find him. I face right, but I see him not. And that's the point of this message. That it is possible for a good person and a decent person to be in a situation where God is absent, where there's no way to break through, where it is just darkness. Total darkness, the dark night of the soul. Job did not disbelieve in God, but he could not find God. He believed if he could only find God, he could state his case and God would vindicate him. His friends said, oh, God's all right, it's your problem, but Job knew it was not his problem. Job knew there was operating here something that was not reasonable or rational. Job understood in his own person the suffering of the innocent. He knew the mystery of evil. He knew the reality of darkness, which is a part of human experience. which his superficial friends could not comprehend, and by which they were threatened so that they went on the attack. But he said, oh, if I knew where I could find him. But he couldn't find him. Well, the book goes on. Just to give you a quick resolution, the debate continues. Finally, God reveals himself. Does he answer the question of suffering? Does he tell Job what it's all about in terms of the suffering of the innocent? No, not a word about it. God does not explain himself, but he does reveal himself. And before the majesty of God, Job bowed down in worship. He did not find the answer to his question, but he found out that God was enough. But let's linger with his anguish for a moment. Let's not rush to the resolution too soon, because the point of this message is that there are moments and seasons in our lives when God is absent, and when we find ourselves absolutely desolate and consequently devastated. The church hasn't handled that very well, I think. Because when one is in that kind of a situation, one may say wild things. Rail at God. Shake one's fist at the Almighty. Deny Him. Accuse Him. And then those of us that are in no pain or suffering grow very nervous. And we rush to God's defense. But if we understood what we were doing, we're not rushing to God's defense, but we're rushing to the defense of our little system, our security. And in that rushing to the defense of God, which is the defense of ourselves, we fail totally to empathize and stand with the one who is experiencing the dark night of the soul. We need to linger there for a moment and recognize that Job, a good man, could not find God and could not find an answer to the mystery of his suffering. We simply need to own that, to acknowledge that, and to know that it may be true of someone here this morning, or it may be true of any of us tomorrow morning. There was another Jew who expressed what Job expressed, saying it a bit differently, but meaning the same thing. Jesus, in the darkness of Calvary, with a sense of abandonment, cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Jesus didn't doubt the existence of God either. He didn't even doubt the goodness of God, but he was experiencing the absence of God, and to experience the absence of God is hell. And he cried out in a soul that was wrenched with the deepest pain, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? It was a prayer, and it was a personal prayer addressed to my God, but addressed to the God whose presence was only known as absence. The God who could not be found, could not be laid hold on. The God who gave no clue, no ray of light. And Jesus died, trusting in the darkness, with a sense of being abandoned. And so we need to acknowledge that that is part of the human experience. And someone ought to come, be able to come to church someday and know that it's not all sweetness and light. Sometimes it's anguish. And the darkness is very real. I suppose that the most vivid example of the irrationality of evil and the suffering of the innocent in human history perhaps has occurred in our own lifetime in the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel, the Jewish writer, whom we know today as an advocate for Jewish causes, chronicled his experience as a child in the German death camps, the Nazi death camps. And the chronicle, which tells the horror of those days when he was a young boy, is eloquently entitled Night. And Elie Wiesel, after watching the smoke curl heavenward from the crematory which consumed his mother and his sister, and after watching day by day as his father died inch by inch, Elie Wiesel found himself as a child losing his grip on God. He wrote of that camp experience: in the evening, lying on our beds, we would try to sing some of the Hasidic melodies. Some talked of God, of His mysterious ways, of the sins of the Jewish people, and of their future deliverance. But I had ceased to pray. How I sympathized with Job! I did not deny God's existence, but I doubted His absolute justice. And then on the eve of, or rather, in the midst of that experience, a young boy who was an attendant at the camp was ordered to be hung with two other officials. And the whole camp was marched out to witness the hanging. And the child was hung, twisting in the air, before the eyes of the whole camp. And Wiesel says, behind him, someone asked, "Where is God? Where is He?" And then they were marched, single file, past the gallows. And he writes, "Behind me, I heard the same man asking, 'Where is God now?' And I heard a voice within me answer him, 'Where is He? Here He is. He is hanging there on the gallows.'" Elie Wiesel's God died, crucified on the rocks of irrational human suffering and violence to the innocent. The eve of New Year's Day, Rosh Hashanah, a day of great festival worship for the Jewish people. And in the camp, 10,000 strong, they gathered to usher in the new year. But he writes, "What are you, my God?" I thought angrily, compared to this afflicted crowd proclaiming to you their faith, their anger, their revolt. "What does your greatness mean, Lord of the universe, in the face of all this weakness, this decomposition, and this decay? Why do you still trouble their sick minds, their crippled bodies?" And the leader of the service intoned, "Blessed be the name of the Eternal." Thousands of voices repeated the benediction. Thousands of men prostrated themselves like trees before a tempest. But Wiesel writes, "But why should I bless Him? In every fiber I rebelled, because He had had thousands of children burned in His pits, because He had six crematories working night and day on Sundays and feast days. How could I say to Him, 'Blessed art Thou, Eternal Master of the universe, who chose us from among the races to be tortured day and night, to see our fathers, our mothers, our brothers end in the crematory. Praised be thy holy name, thou who hast chosen us to be butchered on thine altar. Then he says, this boy, this day I cease to plead. I was no longer capable of lamentation. On the contrary, I felt very strong. I was the accuser. God was the accused. My eyes were open and I was alone, terribly alone in a world without God and without man, without love and without mercy. And he lost his God. H.H. Farmer, a British preacher of a former day, tells the story of preaching one day on the love of God. And after the service, an old Polish Jew came up to him and said, "You have no right to talk about the love of God unless you've stood where I've stood, watching the blood of those dearest to you flow down the gutters on a gray winter's morning." Later, H.H. Farmer said to him, "How then did you come to believe, experiencing what you experienced?" And he said to Farmer, "When I looked at God as presented in the gospel, I knew I was dealing with a God that at least was grappling with the facts, for I saw him presented in Jesus Christ at the cross in the agony and darkness of Calvary. I knew at least that this God, the God of Jesus, was wrestling where I was." And he said, Then I heard the words of Jesus, who out of his darkness prayed, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And I heard his anguished cry, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And I knew that my life was at a crossroads, a crisis. Either I had to stand with Jesus in his undefeated faith in God, or fall into a bottomless pit of bitterness, hatred, and unutterable despair. And that really is the choice. Standing with Jesus in his undefeated trust in God in the darkness, or falling into the bottomless pit of bitterness, hatred, and unutterable despair. Jesus trusted in the darkness, my God, why? Elie Wiesel lost his faith in the horror of the human experience. The old Polish Jew found God in Jesus, right at the cross. François Mauriac, a French Christian, met Elie Wiesel as a young man shortly after this horrible experience, and he writes the foreword to this little book. He says, "And I who believe that God is love, what answer could I give my young questioner, whose dark eyes still held the reflection of that angelic sadness which had appeared one day upon the face of the hanged child? What did I say to him? Did I speak of that other Israeli, his brother, whom he may resemble, the crucified, whose cross has conquered the world? Did I affirm that the stumbling block to his faith was the cornerstone of mine, and that the conformity between the cross and the suffering of men was in my eyes the key to the impenetrable mystery whereon the faith of his childhood had perished. Zion, however, has risen up again from the crematories and the charnel houses. The Jewish nation has been resurrected from among its thousands of dead. It is through them that it lives again. We do not know the worth of one single drop of blood, one single tear. All is grace. If the eternal is the eternal, the last word for each one of us belongs to Him. This is what I should have told this Jewish child, but I could only embrace him weeping. And I'm glad he could only embrace him weeping. And that is the proper response for all of us. When we come upon one who is experiencing the darkness which is so very real. The darkness is real. The old Polish Jew found faith at the cross. Wiesel lost faith in the agony of that hell. Jesus trusted in the darkness. But it behooves us all simply to be silent, to embrace one another, weeping, knowing that the last word was not Good Friday, but Easter Sunday. Believing that if the last word had been Good Friday, there would have been no further word. Living sometimes with white-knuckled grip in the darkness, clinging to the God whose gospel never plays down the darkness, but speaks of a light that the darkness cannot overcome. Sometimes we must simply wait in the darkness, believing in the God who will write the final chapter. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, Amen.